Welcome to the Student of the Game Fire Podcast with your host, Danny B. Today's guest is Thomas Anderson, 22 years of combination experience, captain on Tower 3 for Charlotte Fire Department and cadre member slash instructor with Insight Fire Training, LLC. Growing up, Thomas wasn't really on the path of becoming a career firefighter or attending college. It wasn't until his senior year of high school that shed possibility of making that dream a reality. So with the advice of his volunteer fire chief and college instructors, Thomas found his way to North Carolina. Fast forward to today, and Thomas couldn't have imagined life without being a career firefighter. Learning from TIC guru Andy Starnes, Thomas's whole outlook on life was shaped by the mentors he had and surrounded himself with. With that, I present Mr. Thomas Anderson.
So my name is Thomas Anderson. I am a captain with the Charlotte, North Carolina Fire Department. I've been in the fire service for 22 years. I started when I was 16 as a junior member with the Marrowbone Volunteer Fire Department in Southern Kentucky. Marrowbone Volunteer Fire Department was one of those fire departments that we ran a total of 30-something calls a year on average. Very rural area, 8,000 people in the entire county, the old one-stoplight, not a one-stoplight town, a one-stoplight county. So I got into the fire service because my boss actually at the time was the assistant chief of that fire department. And it was kind of one of those communities where that's just, there was nothing to do. So I rode horses, I rode four wheelers, and then I joined the fire department. That was my life all the way through high school. Found out my senior year of college, or my senior year of high school, that I could actually go to college for this. So that was kind of when I was like, well, crap, had no interest in going to college at the time. And then went to Eastern Kentucky University, joined the Richmond Fire Department and the Whitehall Volunteer Fire Department while I was in at Eastern Kentucky University. And then about my junior year, my advisor at that point, who was a retired fire investigator from Gaston County and Charlotte, actually, he one of the founders of the Charlotte Fire Investigation Task Force. His name was Jim Farr. Actually encouraged me to, and Shane LeCount, actually. He was my advisor my freshman year of college. So between the two of them, they encouraged me to apply for Charlotte because it was one of the only places it was hiring at the time. This was in 2008 going into 2009. So I actually applied in 2008 and got hired in 2009 with the Charlotte Fire Department. So recession was going on. There weren't a whole lot of fire departments hiring. And so here I am now. I've been with the Charlotte Fire Department for, I just celebrated my 15-year anniversary with the Charlotte Fire Department on November 30th of this past year. I've had the privilege of working for a lot of good bosses, having a lot of good firemen on the back of my truck with me when I was on the back, and also now as a company officer, I've had a lot of good firemen on the back. I'm a firm believer that this is a trade craft and that, you know, we have to be good at it. You know, and every day we have to be good at it. So,
okay,
that's my background, man.
All right. So, with your advisors telling you to apply for Charlotte, was it an easy decision to move, pack up from Kentucky, come to North Carolina?
Absolutely not. not even close, actually. My life plan at the time was. I grew up on at the time it was an 800 acre cattle farm. Again, I grew up riding horses, working cows, riding four wheelers and shooting guns. I mean, that was my life as a young child. So my life plan when I went to Eastern Kentucky University was either graduate college and join the military or get on a fire department somewhere. And that fire department was going to be close enough to where I could live on the farm and, continue my life as it was. The problem was, again, like I knew I wanted to be in the fire service. I knew the fire department was my life plan overall. So the problem was nobody was hiring, mm-hmm. You know, at that time, you know, I mean, everybody kept getting waitlisted or they would do hiring freezes. Lexington was going under hiring freezes. Louisville was going under hiring freezes. Cincinnati, Indianapolis, they were all going under hiring freezes at the time. Nashville. And these are all places that I have applications in on. So I was, you know, I was getting ready to be a senior. So, you know, I started looking into the military again and, you know, thinking about, well, maybe that'll be an option for me when I graduate, but, you know, get some life experience, you know, doing that kind of thing. And then all of a sudden, one of my advisors, again, Jim Farr, actually at the time was like, hey, Charlotte's hiring. Charlotte's actually building stations. Like, they were one of the only fire departments in the country at that time that I knew of that was not only hiring, but they were building stations and annexing and growing and doing their thing. And so I was like, you know what? I got a couple friends that have gotten hired down there in the last couple of years. So I'll apply, see what happens. So I applied. I stayed with my friends that live down here, that live in the area. Again, I met these friends in college. College really kind of opened my horizons quite a bit, made me a lot more willing. Even though I stayed in Kentucky, even though Richmond, Kentucky was, still only 2 hours away from home, 2.5 hours away from home. When you're going from an 8,000, person county, an 8,000 population county to a, 80,000 population county, when school's in session, that's culture shock in and of itself. So like there was, so I grew and I learned a lot and things like that while I was in college, not just in the books, but also just about life in general. And really, it really opened my horizons and really made me a lot more willing to take that leap. So I applied again at the time. Did not think I was going to get hired. Charlotte was taking 4,000 applications at a time for, 70, 80 spots a year at that time. And so like I thought there's no way in hell I'm going to get this job. And then all of a sudden I get, I pass all my pass the written, pass the CPAT at the time. Then all of a sudden I get called in for a polygraph. Then all of a sudden I get called in for an interview. I'm on my way home from my interview, 3 hours away from home, 3 hours away from Charlotte. So I'm, it's about a 6.5 hour drive back to Richmond. And so I'm halfway back from home after my interview, and I get a phone call from Emily Leinberger, who is our still to this day our one of our hiring ladies, and they told me I was getting a conditional offer. And so then now I had a decision to make, and I had about 30 days to make it. And again, it's kind of it was either Charlotte Fire Department or try to join the military, and the military wasn't a guarantee at the time. You got waivers and all this kind of crap you got to get through. Here's a department. I've already passed NFPA physicals. I know I can do it. I know I can do the job. So it's either try to join the military and run my chances of maybe I get in, maybe I don't, or join the fire department. And so I chose to come to Charlotte and take that leap. But it was hard. I mean, it was a hard transition to make for sure.
All right. So with you having some experience already with the two departments that you were on while you were at EKU, was it hard going through their academy, or kind of was it a refresher for you?
I would say that's a tough one actually. Because I'd never been through an academy at that point. Like all of my training had been on the job, night classes, weekend schools, things like that up to that point. So I'd never gone through an academy. The Richmond Fire Department, when I got hired there, I was already a certified fireman. So they put me through like a week or two little a week or two little thing. And then they did a lot of on the job training. My employment with the Richmond Fire Department was a co-op through Eastern Kentucky University, where students can work at the fire department. So we got paid a little bit, but it's not like I was a career member of the Richmond Fire Department. It was a career fire department, no volunteers, no volunteer staffing or anything like that. But like, and we worked shift. If you're certified, you're an interior fireman, just like you function just like everybody else. The only exception is you can't drive. And you get to leave the firehouse to go to class. So that was really the only, and you got college credits for taking the class for being an employee there. So like there was no academy there or anything like that. So it was I like to say Charlotte Fire Department is really where I learned to be where really where I learned to be a fireman. I got certified as a firefighter in the state of Kentucky. I was a certified level 2 firefighter in the state of Kentucky, but Charlotte Fire Department is where I learned how to be a fireman, where I truly learned how to function as a team, function as a unit, function with my crew. I learned, everything. They're the ones that taught me how to be a truck fireman. And where I really found that passion. I mean, I rode a ladder company and a tower company in Richmond. Went to some good fires, had a really good time while I was there. But Charlotte's really where they really taught me how to be a truck guy, so and how to be a fireman in general. The academy itself, it was kind of like a 9 to 5, and I'd never worked a 9 to 5 up to that point. I mean, other than working on the farm during the summers and things like that, like this was the first like true what I would say quote unquote 9 to 5 that I'd ever had. While I for that 6 months. It was a drag though. I mean, 6 months in the academy, starting every day at 6 o'clock in the morning, with PT and everything else. I mean, it was hard, but at the same time, like I had spent 3.5 years up to that point while I was in college preparing myself for that, for exactly that. Like I knew I was going to have a 4 to 6 month academy wherever I went, because I knew I didn't want to be on a smaller department. I wanted to go somewhere a little bigger and try something that I had never tried before. That was just kind of, coming from small town roots, man. Like that was the dream was, I mean, I want to be a big city fireman, So that was just kind of the dream that I had. I would say the academy was hard. It was a long, drawn out process, but I did well. I excelled. I think I was number six in my class out of 18. So I wasn't at the bottom of the pack. I wasn't all the way at the top of the pack either. I did well academically. Runs, I'm built for comfort, not for speed. The runs, I wasn't finishing, a mile and a half in 8 minutes or anything like that. But I was able to hold my own, and I never, the biggest thing is I never stopped to walk or anything like that. So it was hard, and it was difficult, but it was very good for me, and for my career, and just in general, it was a good experience for me. Like, I hear a lot of people talk about, oh, when I joined the military, like basic training was a great experience for me. I needed that discipline, I needed that rigidity in my life, and things like that. And for the academy, the Charlotte Fire Academy did that for me. They gave me that discipline that I needed at the time. They gave me that rigidity in my life and in my career, and they really set me on a path. Like up to that point, it was, all right, I'm gonna go take this class because it interests me. I'm gonna go take this class because I know I need it. But there was no order to it. Whereas the Charlotte Fire Department kind of gave me some order to how this stuff is supposed to go, and gave me just that level of consistency in my career.
Awesome. Fantastic. Well explained. Well
I'm
explained.
going too
So,
in-depth on things too. Just tell
no,
me.
you're good. You're good. And so upon completion, what was your first assignment?
First assignment was ladder one on A shift. I was there for a few months. It was a temporary assignment. My class was hired when the Charlotte Fire Department built Station 40. But the problem was Station 40 wasn't done yet. So when we graduated, so we a lot of us anticipated, like we all thought we were going to Station 40. Like that was the extent, the anticipation. And you got to remember too, this is 2010 now. In 2010, there were a ton of guys, with fire departments that were deployed to Afghanistan, Iraq, a lot of deployments going on in the military with the guys on the military. So there were a lot of vacancies on the fire department, even though on Charlotte Fire, even though there were people that filled those spots, they were currently somewhere else. Because 40 wasn't open yet, they just sent us to temporary assignments at those places. So I ended up being very lucky and going to ladder one. Some of our guys went to some really busy spots. Like again, I went to ladder one. We had guys go to engine 12, which is a 5,000 call a year company. We had guys going to 23, which 23 at the time was a 4,000 call a year company. So we had guys go to some really good spots. So I went to ladder one, and I'll say that when I went to ladder one, that was really when everything came into perspective for me on how the Charlotte Fire Department operates. And I'm like, okay, I'm downtown. I'm a big city fireman. Like this is freaking cool. Hearing the Q wail off the freaking, 50-story buildings as we're going down Tryon Street in downtown. Like I thought that was the coolest thing in the freaking world. Like, I mean, I was a kid in a candy store. I'm not gonna lie, I still get goosebumps and the hairs stand up on my arms when I get the opportunity to ride downtown, and for whether it be for the day or wherever, because it's just like that kid in me just pops back out again. Like, man, this is the coolest job in the freaking world, And so that's where I really, but again, being on ladder one, downtown company, we went to several fires, we went to really good calls, and that's where I really learned, like, okay, hey, truck companies do this, truck companies do that, engine companies do this. Like everybody has a job to do, and it all kinds of comes together. So that was where, and then I was like, this is what I want to do. Like, this is what I want to do for the rest of my career. I want to be searching above the fire. I want to be cutting holes in roofs. I want to be cutting people out of cars. Like, this is what I want to do. This is where I'm at. Like, this is it for me. So ladder one was first assignment. Learned a lot while I was there. From there, I had to come off temporary assignment at some point, Did not get lucky enough to stay at ladder one, but I did go to ladder 24. So I was able to stay on a truck company in the southern part of the city. So hated it for the first few months. Didn't hate's a strong word, but like I really wasn't having, I just come from running, over 4,000 calls a year down to a company running 2,500 calls a year. Just still not slow, but I was just kind of like, man, going from that to this, like I want to go back downtown. I want to get back down there. And then for 3 months, we didn't do jack. We didn't go to a fire, didn't go to a pin in. Like we ran nothing but, picking up old people and, just, nothing. And then all of a sudden, one Sunday morning, the world changed for me. And it's like the bottom dropped out of it in 24's area. And, we went to a 3-alarm fire at 11 o'clock in the morning that was called in by CMPD's helicopter that was circling downtown. That's what called in the fire. So it's like, holy crap. So we go to that night we go to a house fire. So now that's my first two fires in a day on a Charlotte fire department. And I've been on the fire department for almost a year. And then we were just kind of off to the races for like 6 months after that. And so like now I'm sitting here thinking, man, this is a great spot to be. So I ended up staying at 24 for a few more years. Before I transitioned myself to an engine company because I figured I better learn that part of the job too. And that's where I'll just say like that is where my career really started. I'm still a truck guy at heart. I ride a ladder company now, ride a tower company now as a company officer. But I spent 3 years working on Engine Company 2 in downtown Charlotte, working for two amazing bosses. Greg Nicholson, Captain Greg Nicholson was the captain on the ladder. And then, my captain and probably one of the most influential people in my entire career, Andy Starnes was my captain. And to anybody listening to this podcast, I don't know if you've ever had Andy on, he'd be a great person for you to have on. But, for anybody listening to this podcast, if you don't know who Andy Starnes is, find out who Andy Starnes is. He is a Not only is he awesome with thermal imaging and the fire service in general, but he is just an amazing mentor to have. I don't feel bashful saying what I'm about to say, and that is that I don't think I would be, I know I would not be the company officer that I am today if it wasn't for him. And I definitely wouldn't be the man or the husband that I am today if it wasn't for his influences on my life and on my career. So probably one of the best decisions I ever made. And it's kind of happenstance the way it happened. I actually met Andy and Greg at FDIC, probably about a year before I went to, probably a year before I transferred to Engine 2. And Greg actually was telling me that, he had an opening coming up on Ladder 2. And I was like, oh man, that'd be freaking sweet, right? Go back downtown, ride a truck company downtown again. That would be awesome. So, he called me when his spot came open. I put in. And thought I was going to get it. And then all of a sudden, somebody else with a little bit more seniority than me put in for the spot and got it over me. And I was like, well, just wasn't meant to be. And all of a sudden, a month later, I get a phone call from Andy saying, hey, look, it's not the ladder, but it's engine two on B shift, same shift. You're going to be able to ride the ladder some and things like that. What do you think? And I was like, I told him at that point, I was like, hey, man, let me think about it. I'm a truck guy. Let me think about it. And, but sure enough, after talking to some other mentors that I had in the job, my driver at the time, Paul DeFranzo, amazing dude. Another one of those dudes that I tell him all the time. I was like, man, I hated you when I first met you because I needed you in my life. And I did. Like, I had real thin skin. I was real easy to get, I was that cocky little son of a bitch fireman that everybody hates at the firehouse. And I needed him. I needed Paul DeFranzo to come in and thicken my skin up and make me, he made me a lot of what I am today too. So, kudos to him as well. But I talked to him and, he's actually now the godfather of my daughter. So, hated the dude's guts for a month. And now he's one of my favorite people in the entire world. But I talked to him, had a lot of counsel with him. He was like, man, look, you need to grow. You need to change. He's like, yeah, I think you should go. And I was like, you know what? Cool. I'm going to go. So I did. And again, the rest is kind of history. Like it's best decision I ever made. One of the best decisions I ever made in the fire service. Again, I would not be the man, captain, fireman, husband, father, anything without my influence from Andy Starnes, once I went to that company. So, and I had a great time too. Like my, first week on the job, we ran like a 4-alarm fire at a bread factory, where Andy says we almost died. I don't think we almost died, but it was a little spicy a couple times. So like went to some good calls, some good fires while I was there, learned a lot. Learned a ton about engine work, and I think a big that in a big way influenced my decision making as a company officer and as a truck fireman. It's a there's something to be said about understanding what the engine's going through underneath of you or behind you or whatever the case may be. And knowing what you're doing is doing for them. That way you can say, you know what, hey, they need more relief down there just from, what you've got coming out of your vent hole or whatever the case may be. But so yeah, so that's kind of, that led me up to station two. And, then like I said, I decided to take the captain's test. Became a company officer, relieved for a couple of years out of Battalion 7. My first assignment was ladder 24 C shift. So I go,
Back.
everything comes per circle. Went back to 24 just on a different shift as the truck company boss on truck 24. Stayed there for 2 years before the opportunity presented itself to go to the academy as a training officer at the academy. Spent my 2.5 years there and came out of the academy about a year and a half ago when Chris Ruffert retired off of Tower 3, and I took his spot and his crew at Station 3. And now, if I have my way, I'll retire off that company. So.
Okay.
It's a good
All right.
spot, man.
I'm going to go back just a little bit. You
Please do.
mentioned when you're on engine two, your captain was Andy Starnes. And I think most people know who Andy Starnes is. So my question to you is, tick at that time, and I'm going to say it's probably still to this day, it's not really sexy work.
Not really.
But what embraced you to go to Andy and absorb all that knowledge that you have now when it comes to ticks?
So I'll say a combination of two things. Number one, I'm interested in everything when it comes to the fire service. Tick is something that I had never really had any experience with. Like I knew we had them, but it was an officer's tool at the time, and I was a fireman riding the back step of the engine company. So unless I was riding the seat, which didn't happen very often, I didn't see it as something that I needed to be interesting my time with at the time. Honestly, it came down to the point where one day I'm sitting at the kitchen table, and Andy came up to me and he handed me this document, on printer paper that he had written, and I find out later that he had written it, and he handed it to me. And he just said, "Hey, I want you to read this and let me know what you think of it." And it was one of the articles. I don't remember the title of it, but it was an article that he had written about, fire service thermal imaging cameras, specifically about mode changes from high to low sensitivity and those advantages and those differences in how you see the fire environment. And I was like, I didn't know any of this shit. I had no idea what any of this stuff was talking about. But that paper that he wrote, or that article that he had written, after I got done writing, I couldn't put it down, first of all. And I finished the article, and next he comes into the kitchen, and I just finished the article, and he was like, "Hey, what'd you think?" And that led to a conversation. This is probably, shortly after lunch that he gave me this article, and that led to a conversation that finally finished at about 3 o'clock in the morning while we're still sitting there drinking coffee at the kitchen table, and I'm just taking everything that this man has to say in. And I've been working for him up to this point for about a year. Like I'd been on his truck for a year, and he had talked about thermal imaging some, and he had talked about going to some conferences. Like he had just started to kind of teach on the conference scene a little bit. Kill the Flashover was kind of it's his dad's brainchild, obviously, and a bunch of other people. But like he was involved in that quite a bit. But for the most part, like he was just really starting to get onto the conference scene a little bit. And had just started really writing some articles and things like that. But yeah, I mean, that's kind of how it started for me. And next thing I know, about a year later, he gets his very first hands-on training class that he's supposed to go teach. And it was all the way in Kentucky. And I tell people that this part is all, his lack of options, essentially. I was the person that showed interest in it. And he came up to me and said, "Hey, I got to go teach this live fire class in Kentucky. I know you're from there. You want to go?" And I was like, "Yeah." And so here I am 10 years later, getting ready to go to Germany with him in 2 days. So a lot's changed, but a lot stayed the same. But as far as like the sexiness of the tick, like it's as sexy as you make it, right? Yeah, I mean, it's just like anything else. A Hallingabar bar is not sexy unless you make it sexy. Like, we make it sexy because we know what to do with it. You know, truck companies know what to do with it. That's what makes a Hallingabar bar sexy. If I just take a Hallingabar bar and start beating on a daggone door with it, that ain't sexy. You know, if I take a thermal imaging camera and I'm sitting there staring at it like this the entire time that I'm going through a building and I never put it down, I never put my hands on objects, I don't know how to scan properly, I don't know what that image is trying to tell me to where I can interpret it and make good decisions based off of what I see, it's not sexy. But if I take that can, if I'm going through a building, you know, if I'm moving swiftly and efficiently and quickly through a building in my 3-point stance, and I come to a door, I pick my camera up, I take a 3 to 5 second scan, put it down, communicate with my guys, and boom, we're on to the next target. Like, that's where it becomes sexy. It becomes sexy when, you know, I mean, I really don't care what it looks like. I think it becomes sexy when your victims are coming out of the building 70% faster. I think it becomes sexy when your survival rates are twice as high. I think it becomes sexy when you have the ability to make faster, more efficient, and more aggressive decisions because you're informed of the environment that you're in. That's the biggest thing for me. It's all a tick is an information gathering tool. That is all it is. It's not a rescue tool. It's not a search tool. It's not a fire attack tool. It's not a size up tool. A tick is an information gathering tool. It's an intelligence tool. That's what it is. Like, that's all it is. It is where am I? Where am I going? Where's my risk and where's my target? You know, where do I need to go? How do I get there? And where are my dangers and where are my targets at? That's what a tick does for you. You know, and you know, if you were to go and tell any military operative in the world, any military operative in the world, that we go into an environment with our eyes closed, essentially, you know, with zero warning, you know, and zero, you know, quote unquote mission prep. I mean, because there's no way. I mean, when they killed bin Laden, you know, when SEAL Team 6 killed bin Laden, they reconstructed what they thought that compound looked like based on intelligence. And that SEAL team trained on it for days prior to, you know, executing that mission. And then here we are, you know, and I'm not saying that you know, this isn't, you know, we don't have any other choice but to do this, but, you know, here we are at 3 o'clock in the morning and sound asleep. We could be, you know, called on to at somebody's worst day, you know, to function at that same level. And I mean, if you don't believe that we have to function at that same level as military operatives, as military special forces operatives, then you're crazy. You know, because it is the same level of expectation. Now, to quote Sean Duffy, actually another good friend of mine, good mentor of mine, to quote Sean Duffy, when you go to anybody in Mooresville Fire District, you come to anybody in Station 3's area in Charlotte, you ask any of those people, hey, what do you expect of your fire department? You know, they're going to tell you two things: save my life, save my shit. That's it. That is their expectation. And they don't care how it happens. They don't care if you use a thermal imaging camera or don't use a thermal imaging camera. But I can promise you that if they find out that half of their building could have been saved or half of their stuff could have been saved, you know, if you had simply had a little bit more information about that building, they're going to be a little bit pissed. That's the expectation. The expectation is not only do we know the job and we know the building, but we know every single piece of equipment that we have in our arsenal. And the tick is no different. The biggest problem in the American Fire Service is the lack of tick education, you know, because it's not required anywhere. It's not required for officers. I mean, NFPA mandates it, but you tell me a firefighter 1 and 2 training program that really does a good job teaching firefighters about ticks. Not to mention the fact that in a firefighter 1 and 2 training program, let's say you do 4 hours tick training, when's the next time you're going to pick that camera up and actually use it? It's still an officer's tool. You know, so how many officer development programs go over thermal imaging? How many officer development programs do thermal imaging training under live fire conditions and things like that? I've very rarely found them. Most of them are after we've come in and done classes and things like that. So to me, it's a lack of knowledge and it's a lack of training and education, which goes back to the implementation of thermal imaging in the fire service. So how was this shit rolled out to us? Because it wasn't rolled out to us by a bunch of firemen coming together and saying, hey, we need thermal imaging in a fire service. Let's create a thermal imaging camera, you know, for our usage. No, it was, you know, manufacturers that came and they were like, hey, you know what? Firefighters deal with heat. They could probably use something to read heat. Let's design something without taking their input into it, and then we'll just give it to them and say, hey, here it is. You know, green button turns it on, red's bad, have a nice day. You know, and that's really the education that 90% of the fire service has when it comes to thermal imaging cameras. Red's bad, green button turns it on, have a good day. The problem is not the cameras. The problem is not our skills on the fire ground. The problem is we've never been given the training and education on how to take this piece of equipment and apply it here. How to take this tick and apply it to size up. How to take this tick and apply it to fire attack. How to take this tick and apply it to search. We've never been taught any of those things. I was never taught any of those things. I was never taught what, until I met Andy Starnes, I was never taught what his voice was going to sound like while I was searching a structure, and the things that he was going to say to me while I was searching, so to clue me in as to what was in the building. It's not about whether or not I get lost in a 12 by 12 room. I mean, it's not like, I think all of us can say safely that we should all be able to individually by ourselves search a 12 by 12 room without a tick. Of course, absolutely. But is it not beneficial for me to know, as I'm moving through that space, there's a crib in this room, or that there's two additional rooms in this room, or that there is a bunk bed in the space, or whatever the case may be? Are there's not beneficial pieces of information for me to know? Absolutely, they are. Absolutely, they are. My brain can go ahead and start processing that information. Andy scans behind me as I'm searching a space and just yells, "Crib." Now I know. Hey, it's clued into my head. Hey, there's a crib in here. I get all the way back around to the room, to the doorway, and I didn't search a crib, then I know I missed something. Or hey, as soon as I touch something that feels like it's got rails on it, hey, I'm in front of it, I'm dumping it down into my lap, I'm scooping and I'm working. So it's not just about seeing and constantly having it in front of your face. I mean, that's not how we use thermal imaging. That's not the appropriate way to use thermal imaging. The appropriate way is for us to gather intelligence, gather information, disseminate that to the guys that need it, and work. That's how we do it. That's how this, and that's kind of where everything in my career, everything from my experiences with Andy has led me. I took the foundation of thermal imaging that he gave me. Andy's an engine guy. I mean, his focus is fire attack and engines and size up and decision making and things like that. So I kind of came in and I took all that stuff that he was talking about, and I was like, hey, let's develop a, and I'm not saying that Andy didn't do search stuff. He absolutely did before I got to him, but I was like, hey, let's take this stuff and actually put it into a clear cut, like, what's, I'm trying to think of the right word to say, like a clear cut methodology. And that's where enhanced search methodology, the terms came from. And then, like that's where all that came from. Like this is a methodology of how you apply thermal imaging to search, how you communicate what you see, how you scan rooms effectively and efficiently to make sure you see the whole thing and see the big picture. But it goes down to, like, when we teach a search class, it goes down to like making sure that we teach people, like, look, I don't expect my crew members. We actually just did these drills last week with my crew. My crew knows, like, they don't need me to scan a room prior to them entering it. They're still going to enter a room if they get to it before me. They're going to close the door behind them. They're going to search the space. They're going to vent as they go. When I come up to that door behind them, I'm still going to crack it, scan it. If I don't see anything, they may not hear my voice, or they may just hear me say, "Hey, right here, I'm good." And then boom, I close the door and I go on about my day. They may hear me pop open, scan it, and I'll just yell one of them's name, Chris. They'll stop, they'll acknowledge me, and I'll say, "Bunk beds," or "crib," or whatever the case may be. It's a 2 second exchange, and boom, they're moving on. Then I close the door again and I keep going. I'm not sitting there staring at them, watching them through the eyes of the camera. That's all part of our intelligently aggressive search class that we teach, is not just scanning and looking and seeing, but how to communicate, how to actually put all of this stuff together in a methodology that works on the fire ground, that works with our aggressive culture, that works with our aggressive lifestyle, and that works with our dynamic fire ground and our crew sizes and things like that. So it's not just about this one piece of equipment. It's about how that piece of equipment fits into the big picture, how it fits into your decision-making profile, how it fits into your communication profile, and things like that.
Love it. Okay. And one thing that when you just said it hit on me. I thought about how many crews would actually wait on the officer before they go in the room, or hey, he's got to tell me I got to go in and search. I can't just do that. But that comes through the sets and reps that you guys have.
Absolutely. And the first time that we ever, the first time when I got to Tower 3, the first time that we did this, like, It was all just kind of chaotic. Like they were going, they were searching. Not gonna lie, like they were doing exactly, they were doing a great job. They were doing good searches. Like I've got a really jam up crew, but me throwing me into the mix basically with my methodology and with my ideals, we had to come to some kind of an understanding on how this was gonna look. And so, just, one day I was just like, hey guys, like let's try this. Like let's hard stop. Let's try this and see. And coming out of it, they were like, holy crap, like that was awesome, loved it. And then that led to some really good conversations. And that was where the conversation came up of, hey, do you want me to wait on you at this doorway? And I'm like, absolutely not. Like, if I tell you Chris stairs left, boom, Chris is going upstairs and he's working his way to the upstairs bedrooms. I may still be downstairs with my other firemen, whether it be Todd or Harrison. There's two of my firemen, two of my other guys in the rig. I may be downstairs with Todd and Harrison still, locating, isolating, and dumping a can on fire, while Chris is upstairs, working ahead of us and rocking on. It doesn't mean that I'm not coming behind him and scanning those rooms and checking those rooms. Even if he's finished them, he could be two rooms ahead of me. When I see him at the end, hey, did you get that bunk bed? Did you get that crib in those two bedrooms? Yep, got him, Cap. Cool, we're good. Or, oh crap, there was a bunk bed in there? Yeah, there was, man. Hey, let's go back and get it. So boom, we scoot back and we knock it out. We're human at the end of the day. Like I said, it's 3 o'clock in the morning. We've been sleeping all, if you've been sleeping all night long, I mean, when was the last time you searched a structure? For example, I mean, Tom Brady threw how many thousands and thousands and thousands of footballs every single summer, to become a seven-time football champ, seven-time Super Bowl champion, and we're searching buildings. How often are we searching buildings, whether it be in training or in real fires? How often are we searching structures? How often are we listening to that communication? It's not about, whether or not Chris or Harrison or myself are good at searching that space. It's about the fact that we're human and it's 3 o'clock in the morning. And hey, we can miss things. It's zero visibility. Not saying it's acceptable to miss things. That's why I'm coming back and I'm scanning behind the guys, even if they've already finished a room. Like, yeah, I'm going to go ahead and scan that room again. It's not that I don't trust them to do a good job. It's just that I'm going to make sure that there wasn't something hidden here, hidden there that was odd or weird that they did that would be easy for them to miss or easy for them to not catch. So it's all about how that methodology comes together and how it all works within itself. That's kind of where it's all at, man.
Love it. Love it. Okay. With that being said, you mentioned how Andy is a huge mentor in your life. How important is it for others that hopefully are listening to understand that we need those individuals to kind of shape us and guide us to become who we are?
It's essential, man. It's absolutely essential. I'm not saying that there aren't people out there that can't be successful without good mentors, but man, you're starting from behind the eight ball. You're absolutely starting from behind the eight ball. Mentorship is essential in this job. And, every rank should be mentoring the guys underneath them. Even if it's I mean, when I was in recruit school, I had mentors, when I was, that were other recruits, on the fire, on the same fire department that I was on. I was also mentoring other guys in my recruit class that had zero experience, and things like that. So mentoring is not a, oh, you got to have 30 years experience to be a good mentor. That ain't how it works. I mean, you could have 5 minutes on the job and still be mentoring somebody. I mean, it doesn't matter. As what matters is that you have something to offer and that you're listening, that you're willing to learn, and that you're willing to grow yourself. I mean, because you don't want a mentor that's not willing to grow themselves. I mean, that's the other side to it too. Just because somebody has 30 years on the job, do they have 30 years on the job? Do they have 30 years experience, or do they have 1 year experience 30 times? Like that's the other side of this. Like, how much have you really grown? I don't put a whole lot of stock into, I mean, I do, don't get me wrong. Like, seniority's got its perks, obviously. But I'm always a little cautious of not, I'm like, your years of experience is not the only thing that I'm looking at when I'm looking for A, a mentor, when I'm looking for B, a senior man on my rig, all that kind of stuff. Like, there's a lot of other qualities there too. You could be 30 years on the job and still be an idiot. I mean, you could be, 5 years on the job and be one of the best firemen I've ever met. I mean, it doesn't, it, years of experience don't necessarily equate to being good or shitty. So, mentor back to, back to your original question on mentoring, like mentors are essential in this job. I mean, they're absolutely essential, but not just like, again, with Andy, for myself, for example, Andy was a mentor to me in way more ways than just the fire service. And in fact, I would say the fire service was probably maybe 30% of the mentoring that he did for me. Like half of our conversations, or more than half of our conversations at the kitchen table, were revolved around life and love and family. And, I mean, I had my daughter while I was assigned to station two. So I was a new father. I mean, my wife got pregnant while I was at 24, and then I transferred to station two about a month or two before my daughter was born. So, I was still a new husband as well. I mean, we'd only been married for about a year when my daughter was born. So I was learning how to be a husband. I was learning how to be a father. I was still learning how to be a fireman. Hell, I'm still learning today how to be a good fireman. I was learning a lot, and I was in a very transitional phase in my career. So I would say, like, it's so important not just to have mentors in the fire service, but to have fire service mentors for life as well, and just have life mentors in general. I mean, and I will equate a lot of the life lessons that Andy taught me, again, about being a father, about being a husband, and just spiritually and life in general. I will transition a lot of that over to the fire service lessons as well. A lot of those lessons go hand in hand. The fatherhood lessons that I learned from not only him, but like, Robbie, Robbie Harris was another fireman on the back of engine two that had been he had teenage kids at the time. Brian Gilmore, who had teenage daughters at the time. Our driver, Wallace Martin, again, had adult kids at the time. So like I had a broad range. I had a lot of really good life mentors and these guys that I could look up to help teach me how to be a good father and a good husband. And I'm learning, and I'm just now today, my daughter's 10 now, going on 11. I'm just now today seeing the things that they were complaining about, several years ago when I was at station two. And I'm like, yeah, you know what? Hey, it all here it is. This is what Robbie was talking about. This is what Brian was talking about. So like, it's so important to have mentors, but it's also just important to have guys that, have been through some of the things that you're getting ready to go through in life in general, and just having those life mentors. Like I said, Andy taught me a lot about being a fireman. And Brian Gilmore taught me a lot about being a fireman, and so did Robbie Harris. And Wallace Martin taught me a lot about driving, and about pump operating, things like that. But I learned a lot from these guys when it came to fire service. But I would say some of the most beneficial conversations I had with these guys were sitting around a kitchen table, and we didn't bring up fire service once. We talked about our families, we talked about life, we talked about our hardships, we talked about their small businesses that they had on the side, and I'm learning business lessons from these guys. And the fire station is just such a diverse culture in and of itself, diverse experience, life experiences. Half my fire station, when I was at station two, half of them hunted, and that was their thing. They hunted. And the other half, like, we're city boys, and had never been in the country, but we all lived harmoniously, and we all had different life experiences and things like that. So it's just a crazy dynamic. And like, you have to surround yourself with people that are going to make you better one way or the other. And that's where the mentorship part starts, right? Like, I'm not going to sit there and listen to the mentor that's screaming at me, or the guy that's trying to be the mentor screaming at me that he's the senior man, but he's doing it from the recliner. That's not a senior man. That's not somebody that I want to hang my hat on as a mentor. Yeah, I've been on for 30 years. I'm the senior man on this truck, and he's doing it with his feet propped up on the recliner, at 10 o'clock in the morning. That's not a senior man. That's not a mentor that I want to have in my corner. So a lot of these times you're going to have to go look for it. Like, there's always going to be somebody out there that wants to tell you that they're your mentor, that wants to tell you that they're your senior person, or whatever the case may be. But you have to go out and find it. Like, you've got to find who's going to be the best mentor for you. And you can't let your fire department assign it to you. Like, that's not necessarily the best idea. Mentorship programs that fire departments have are great. They do great, great things, and they do a good job sometimes of pairing guys up. But I mean, that's not the mentorship that I'm talking about that I had. Like, I had mentors that I fell into it. I fell into these mentors. I fell into Andy Starnes. I fell into, Robbie Harris, and I fell into Paul DeFranco. I'll say actually, I ran into Paul DeFranco. He was the brick wall that I slammed right into early on in my career. But these were all guys that were extremely influential in not only my career but in my life. And I wouldn't be where I am today without those people. And I think everybody needs that. Like everybody needs to have people like that. That, I mean, Paul DeFranco is one of those guys that I haven't talked to Paulie in months probably, but I guarantee I could pick a phone right now and call him. He's going to answer it, and he's going to probably cuss me out as soon as he picks up the phone, and as soon as, and et cetera, et cetera. Andy Starnes is probably traveling, but I think he's traveling back from Canada today. If he's not on an airplane, I promise you, I could call him right now and he's going to answer the phone. And, we'll talk as long as I need to. And everybody needs people like that. Everybody needs that group of people that they can call on if they need to. That's true mentorship right there. That's true mentorship.
Definitely, definitely. Okay. With that being said, at what point in your career did you decide, like, no one's ever ready, but when you were like, hey, I think I want to go up for company officer?
That's a tough one. So I 100% agree with you. I don't think anybody's ever truly ready for that transition. And I'm no different. But I would say that I took the test just to take it. First year that I took the year I got promoted, I was a one and done promotee. I had 8 years on the job. I think I was going on my 8th year with the Charlotte Fire Department. 14 years in the fire service at that point, but my 8th year was Charlotte, and the test popped up. I was eligible, and I was like, you know what? I'll take it. I'll see what it's all about. I read one book. This is the only book I read. I read John Norman's Handbook of Tactics. That was the only book on the reading list that I read. And lo and behold, it just happened to be a year that probably 80% of the test was John Norman's Handbook of Tactics. And so I was kind of like, oh shit. And I get my results back, and I had passed. Had a fairly respectable score too. Like it wasn't top of the line, wasn't bottom either. It's kind of like right there in the middle of the pack of the people that had passed. And I was like, well, shit, I'm in the game now. So it's like I got to play to win, right? So that was when I really started preparing, I guess, to be a company officer. I mean, I think you're preparing to be a company officer or leadership roles from day one in the fire service, but that was when I really started saying, okay, how do I be a captain with the Charlotte Fire Department specifically? And again, going back to my mentors, like Andy Starnes was huge. Andy and Greg Nicholson both, they were huge in helping me with that, learn that. Because they flat out told me, they were like, look, here's the deal. We're going to run you through fire problems. We're going to run you through, problems, state, oil boards, things like that. But they were like, look, we're not going to help you prepare for the test. Like, we're helping you prepare to be a company officer. So when I went in and for my testing process, I literally went in there with the mindset of I'm going to tell these people exactly how I would handle this as a company officer, as a fireman. I'm not going to tell these people what I think they want to hear. Like, I'm going to tell them this is how I would handle it on the street. And that's exactly how I went into it. Apparently it worked because I got promoted. I was probably 3/4 of the way down the pack of the actual final list of company officers. I think there were 28 people on the list. I was like number 18 or 19, something like that. And we promoted like 25, 26 that year. So I was towards the end. So the funny story here, sidebar, funny story to this is I was towards the end enough that the following year, I didn't know 100% that I was going to get promoted yet. So I was like, well, I got to take the test again. And so I took the test the second year, failed it. Failed the written test the second year. But I got promoted off of the first list. So I was like, well, cool. So now I'm dealing with, so at that point, now I'm dealing with, now really am I ready for this? But again, like it was to a point where like I didn't read Jack the second year because again I was kind of on that cusp where I was like, do I even need to take the test again or not? I better take it. So hadn't been studying for a written test or anything like that. But yeah, went and took the test, failed it by like 2 points, and I was like, well, shit. So, but again, got lucky, got promoted, and here I am. So they didn't take my birthday away from me. So.
You mentioned that, truck work is a huge passion of yours, but one of the things that also hit me with intriguement was the fact that you were like, you also wanted to learn engine work as well. But besides that, why do you have a love for truck work?
I like the autonomy of it. I like the and again, like I'm a firm believer that every company's got its place on the fire ground. Jim Squitieri, fireman in Charlotte, is probably one of the most artistic people I've ever met on a hose line, with a nozzle or as a backup man or anything else. The man can do is Vincent Van Gogh with a freaking engine, with a freaking hose line or an engine company. There's no denying that everybody has their every company has their place on the fire ground. But for me, I like the autonomy of being on a truck crew and the possibility of, being able to, as a fireman on the back, make decisions on the roof by myself because my boss is down low, operating on the main floor with the fire, on the fire floor or searching the floor above or whatever. I love the idea of operating above the fire and having that distance, have that distality between me and the seat of the fire. I love search. I love that, again, that mindset, that critical thinking aspect that you have to have. It's not just a there's fire, go to it, and I'm not, I know there's more to engine company work than that, but I like that autonomy of it, the decision-making aspect, the critical thinking aspect of things, the technical aspect of truck work on a fire ground, and having to make those evaluations of, hey, we started with a 4x4 hole, but is that enough? It's not just, so many times, and again, that goes, so many times I see truck crews get up there, they make the standard Academy 4x4 hole, and they don't ever take a second to evaluate, hey, is it working? Just because it's a single family dwelling that's 2,000 square feet, how much fire is underneath of you? Does it need more? Does it need to be a 6x4 or a 6x6 or even an 8x8? Depending on, the lift that they're getting down below and things like that. So, yeah, I mean, I would just have to say it's the autonomy of it, the critical thinking aspect of it. And at the end of the day, it's fun. Operating on a roof is fun. Venting or search is fun. Pulling ceilings and opening up hidden fire is fun. So at the end of the day, it's fun. But I do love that autonomy, the critical thinking aspect of being on a truck crew and being a truck boss, especially.
And with you being a company officer, what does leadership mean to you? I mean, I'm sure you've heard we learn from good and bad officers growing up in the fire service, but
Oh, yeah.
what does leadership mean to you, and what kind of leader did you want to be?
Loaded, hard question, man. Good job. Nice job on this question. So I mean, again, leadership is small unit leadership is kind of where I go back to with this because it's all, we're operating, company officers, even battalion chiefs, like you're really still dealing with fairly small units, so small unit leadership is kind of what it all comes back to for me. And I wanted to be a company officer that took care of my guys. I wanted to be known as a competent company officer, but I wanted to be one of those company officers where the guys know that number one, that I'm not going to bullshit them. I want them, my guys know, and I feel like my guys know now that if they screw up, I'm going to tell them that they screwed up. But at the same time, I'm going to make sure that they are treated consistently within the confines of the rules and regulations of the Charlotte Fire Department. I expect my guys to own up to their mistakes, and I expect my guys to accept responsibility for their mistakes, but I don't expect them to fall blindly on a sword at the same time. And my job is to be the shield for that sword, so to speak. And I wanted my guys to, number one, know that I was competent, and I wanted to be a competent company officer that made good, sound decisions for my crew. But I also wanted my crew to know that I'm going to take care of them, and that they and I want to be transparent with them. I wanted to be a transparent company officer to the point to where they know what to expect from me. It's not going to be something different every single shift. Like I had bad company officers that every shift you never knew what you were getting. From this day to this day, you had no idea what you were getting. I didn't want that. Like I wanted they need to know exactly what they're getting from me on any given day. As far as what leadership means to me, I mean, I don't really know how to answer that because it's kind of, I don't want to just give you the, oh, it's essential because it is, but like it's kind of one of those things where what does leadership mean to me? Leadership means taking care of my guys, taking care of my crew, having a, leading from below as well, because, I have a battalion chief that's above me and, anything that I can do to take things off of his plate, whether it be, organizing training for our battalion or whatever the case may be. I mean, our battalion chiefs stay busy with stuff that's other than calls, so, anything that I can do to take things off of his plate to make his job easier, leadership is something to me that, starts again, like it starts day one of recruit school, that mentorship process that we talked about earlier. You're always preparing for that next role, for that next step up, in your career. You should be anyway. And, that's no different. I mean, being a company officer is, I never really had what I would say was quote unquote a career plan as far as I knew on day one that I wanted to be a company officer. Like I never had that. I kind of, I won't say I fell into the role because I did decide to take the test and I decided to, start that process. But, it was kind of a last minute thing. Like it was about 2 months before the test that I was like, ah, you know what? I'll sign up for it. So, I don't know if I believe that people are born leaders. They're, I don't know any of that. I think it's a little bit of both. I think people are born with certain traits that, allow them to be good leaders. But I also think that those traits can be taught, can be trained. I also think that there are people that are just inherently bad leaders. And no matter what they do, they're just going to be bad leaders. And, that it is what it is. We all know people like that. But yeah, so like leadership is extremely important to me. It's something that I value in my heart. But as far as the leader that I wanted to be a good, transparent, competent, on the fire ground leader that took care of his guys. And at the end of the day, like I don't care if 1,000 people remember my name someday, when I'm gone out of the fire service. At the end of the day, the only people that I really care that remember my name are my wife and daughter, when I leave the fire service. Because at the end of the day, when I leave Charlotte Fire Department, when I retire from Charlotte Fire Department, I ain't captain of nothing anymore. Those are the people that I really want to lead, that I want to lead in life. I want to lead my wife and lead my daughter on prosperous paths in life. I want to lead my daughter to be a good, strong young woman that watches over people and that is going to stand up for what she believes in. I want to lead my wife to be a strong, passionate mother. I mean, that's what leadership means to me, like at the end of the day. But yeah, like, I mean, at the end of the day, sitting around the kitchen table, when I retire, if the guys that I leave behind when I retire, if I don't, there's two types of firemen that get talked about it at the kitchen table. There's the guy that's a good fireman. Hey, here, he was a good fireman. He was a nice guy.
Yeah, you don't want the
And
latter.
you don't want to be the nice guy. You want to be remembered as the good fireman. And if I get that, if I can accomplish that, with my small circle, of people, then I'm happy.
Absolutely. Okay. All right. With that being said, how important is it for individuals to get outside of their bubble, meaning when it comes to outside training? I can say with you working for Charlotte, you guys a good majority of you guys and gals get to put your training into work with the amount of fires that you go to. But how important is outside training for others that might not have an organization where they can see the sets and reps that you guys do?
I think it's important for everybody. From your standpoint that you're talking about, like the people that don't get the sets and reps, that don't go to, that don't go to a fire a week or whatever the case may be. I mean, for those people, it's crazy important because, anytime you can go get a good quality rep, whether it be forcing doors or, stretching lines or whatever the case may be, is gold. And the other side to it is, there's only so much stretching that you can do in a parking lot. There's only so much forcing a door that you can do at the academy. So anytime you can add some realism to it, with these outside trainings with, smoke and fire and different buildings that you're not familiar with, from that standpoint of, how many times have you crawled through Mooresville's burn building at this point?
Right.
How many times have I crawled through Charlotte's burn buildings at this point? I mean, I can sit here and draw pictures of them from of you pictures of them, with my eyes closed, on my little doodle pad that I've got sitting over here. Just that aspect of things, just going somewhere where you're not familiar with the layout with this, and different people follow different rules, right? I mean, like the Charlotte Fire Department, we don't have any furniture inside of our burn buildings, whether you agree with it or disagree with it or whatever. The way that our training academy has interpreted the standard, the NFPA 1403 standard, no furniture inside the burn building. So like we rely on building furniture out of pallets and things like that, out of those Class A combustible materials, for all of our containers, stuff like that. We have things in there, like I said. We've built couches, we've built beds, we've built walls, we've built all this stuff, to give us so that we're not just searching in an open floor plan. But maybe you find a class where they're actually using real beds, furniture, real couches, real stuff laying around the building. So like those sets and reps are extremely important, and a lot of times you have to go outside your organization to get them. But even the Charlotte Fire Department, I can't rely on only the Charlotte Fire Department's perspective, because then my department never grows, right? Like if I rely on nothing but the perspective of the Charlotte Fire Department, and if 100% of my fire department felt the same way, we got 1,200 people. If all 1,200 of us did nothing but the bare minimum that the Charlotte Fire Department requires of us, the department's never going to grow. If we all stayed right here in our little Mecklenburg County bubble, the department's never going to grow. So we even rely on people. Charlotte Fire Department adopted the Nozzle Forward program because Jim Squitieri went and took Nozzle Forward at FDIC on his own, out of class, dudes from Coast, West Coast engine voodoo stuff, I mean. And I've met Aaron Fields. I've taken Nozzle Forward 3 times now. Amazing class. I mean, I learned so much about being an instructor. I consider Aaron Fields a Aaron pro Aaron Fields probably doesn't even know my name, but I consider him a mentor just from taking his class 3 times, and the things that I learned about teaching and about being an instructor just from taking his class, and about how him and his cadre carry themselves and things like that is amazing. But anyway, I digress. But the Charlotte Fire Department adopted Nozzle Forward because Jim Squitieri went and took that class and brought it back, brought it to Charlotte, and the union put it on for us. And then kind of grassroots effort started, from the bottom of the Charlotte Fire Department, with the engine companies adopting, Minuteman loads and different methodologies of moving hose. Then we had some guys go to a high rise ops conference. Myself included was one of those. And that's kind of how we adopted the Dave McGrail, Chief McGrail method of, the Denver fold of high rise packs and things like that. So no matter what department you work for, if you don't get outside your bubble, then you're never going to grow. Your department's never going to grow. It's never going to change. Even if you go to these conferences and you see some jacked up crap going on, you can even learn from that stuff and go, oh, we don't ever want to do that. I mean, there's a lot of validity to going outside of your agency to go take classes. I personally think it's essential. It's absolutely essential to go and get outside your comfort zone and get outside your department's comfort zone. And, your department, one thing, I mean, Charlotte Fire Department doesn't spend a ton of money sending people to conferences. Most of our people spend this money on their own. They spend their own money. It's hard for us to even get, ed leave to go take a conference and go to conference classes and things like that. So like, and a lot of that is, has to do with staffing and finances, and we're dealing with a huge machine when it comes to City of Charlotte's budget. But at the end of the day, if your fire department's not investing in your people to get outside the department and go take other classes, I mean, training divisions should be ch sending their training officers all over the country to take classes and to get fresh perspectives on things. Deputy chiefs should be going all over the country and taking classes and taking leadership classes and seeing how other departments operate and things like that. And if they're not doing that, like, are they really doing what's best for the people under them? Are they really doing, is that training staff that never sends anybody to an outside the department class, are they really doing the best thing for the members on the street, by not getting a fresh perspective and not getting fresh perspectives on things? So little things like that, man. But yeah, it's absolutely essential.
Love it. Love it. Okay. And my last question for you, where would you like to see yourself within the fire department before you decide to hang it up?
So I hope and pray that I retire from the Charlotte Fire Department as a captain on Tower 3A shift. It's where I am right now. And if I can spend the rest of my career right where I'm at, then man, that'd be amazing. I love where I'm at. I love my guys. I love being a company officer. In my opinion, I think being a company officer is the best job in a fire department. And to be a company officer of a ladder company is even better, or being a company officer of a truck company. But I'm also a realist. We put our bodies through hell. So my body will dictate where my career takes me. Whether maybe it takes me back to the academy someday, or maybe it pushes me to promote or something like that. But as of right now, my entire goal is to stay the captain of Tower 3 A shift.
Okay. All
Tell
right.
my wife bye. She's going to work.
No, you're fine. You're fine. Thank you for
Love
thank you for sharing him. Appreciate
course, anytime, Kim. Love you,
it.
babe.
Have a good day. But no, other than that, the only other thing that I would add would be that, currently right now, I'm working on the ladder company operations committee that, we're rewriting the ladder company ops tax for the Charlotte Fire Department. I worked with a group of people, over the last 5 years. We've been writing the Charlotte Fire Department ladder company operations manual, which hopefully will be released sometime this year, hopefully in 2025. When it is, it'll be posted all over my daggone Facebook page. So I can promise you that, once we publicize it. But I hope to continue to work on things like that within my department. I hope to continue, driving my department forward in different areas, whether it be, truck work or leadership or whatever the case may be. I just want to stay, I guess I just want to stay relevant within my department as somebody. I want to keep educating myself. Staying relevant is probably a bad choice of words, but I want to keep educating myself, within my department. And in general, I just want to continue to educate myself and to continue to make myself an asset to my department, when it comes to policy driven things and stuff like that. I want to continue to advance as a company officer. I want to continue to develop my people, and I want to continue to see my people succeed. If I could see every single member of my truck promoted, at some point, that'd be amazing. If that's what they want,
Right.
if they want to stay on the back step of my rig, I think that's, I, you know, back, you know, to the leadership point. I don't mean to backtrack, but to the leadership point, that's the other side to it. I was driven for my entire career. I was always told never pass up a promotional opportunity. But at the same time, guys, we need 20-year firemen. We need 30-year firemen. We need guys that have this desire to be the best freaking backstep fireman that they can possibly be. We need people like that in the fire service. My thing is, don't just say, I'm happy as a backstep fireman and stop. You have to continue driving, continue bettering yourself, continue training and teaching and taking classes and mentoring the future generations and things like that. You want to retire as a backstep fireman? Great, awesome, love it. But be the best damn backstep fireman you could possibly be, and be the best damn mentor to the rookies and the junior guys that you can possibly be. That's my only caveat to that. But yeah, I mean, but as far as, again, back to round it back out, where I want to be, I would love to retire as the captain on Tower Company 3A shift. I want to retire with the respect of my crew, and the guys in my firehouse and the bosses that I work for. And I want to continue to be a part of helping to advance my fire department, and drive them into the future, and leave it better than I found it. I mean, that's everybody always says, oh, leave the fire service better than you found it, right? And at the end of the day, that's my dream. My dream is to leave the Charlotte Fire Department just a little bit better than I found it in 2009. Charlotte has become my home. I spent the vast majority of my life in Kentucky and, kind of moving around the southern United States. But I have by far been in Charlotte and in the Charlotte metro area for the longest period of time in my life at this point. I've been here for 15 years. Charlotte's home. I want to leave this place better than I found it.
Okay. I want to be considerate of your time, but I got one more question for
Yeah,
you. Because
and your time.
since you mentioned that you and others are developing, a ladder tactic book, how would you go about, like, let's just say if an individual wanted to get their department up to what the cert standards are, how would you go about doing that without, you're going to ruffle some feathers? Because it's my opinion, if you have chiefs, whether it's the training chief or the fire chief of an organization or the operations chief that doesn't quite understand, like, the way they did things has so much evolved and changed, and we need to get up to the new standards. How would you go about doing that if somebody was trying to do that for their department?
Hit them with data, man. Like that's the we have so much, but here's the thing, right? So, everybody's got one of these in their pocket now. These things are awesome, but they're also the devil, right? Because I can find an argument. I can find an argument to fit my narrative online just by a Google search. If I wanted to look, if I wanted to find a narrative that said that thing right there is not an axe on the back of that wall, I guarantee I could find one. I guarantee it that I could probably find an argument that says that's not a wall, but that's a something else. I don't know. Like, I mean, you can find an argument for anything. So I would say hit them with data, man. Like hit them with true blue good data. We have a lot of resources out there now. I mean, you mentioned search, so I'll just hit search, because that's one thing that I am hitting hard in our ladder company ops manual, and I'm driving hard in our training division and things like that. Like, the dirty drags are still taboo in the Charlotte Fire Department as far as from a training academy standpoint, the only thing you can do is hit them with data, so I hit them with the search study, I hit them with firefighter rescue surveys data, things like that, all this data that's out there that's free, as far as just the way things have changed. But the biggest thing is you have to be ginger with it too. Like, I don't want to say like you have to stroke their egos or anything like that, but you kind of do at the same time, like, you can't go in there and be like, oh, the way we've done it for 20 years is stupid. Well, this is the way we got to do it. You've got to go in there and say, hey, there's been some recent research and documentation that says, hey, the way we've been doing this for the last 20 years may not be the best way. This is it. Like, this is the research that I found. Let's go through it together, and make them a part of the conversation. Make those company or make those chiefs and make those administrative officers, make them a part of the conversation, not somebody that you're talking at or talking to or anything like that. Make them a part of the decision making. Don't just bark it down and bark it down their throats. That's kind of where I would go with it. But for us, it was a grassroots thing. We wrote the entire ladder company operations manual in its entirety, essentially, before the command staff ever knew we were working on it. And all of a sudden, then we went to the command staff and we were like, boom, here it is. Like, what do you think? And then we presented it to them and they were like, wow, this is awesome. And now and that it was completed about a year and a half ago. But now that we're going into rewriting our ladder company operations tax, our tactical operation guidelines, now we're going back in and we're saying, okay, what lines up, what needs to be changed, what needs to be updated, where can we go more in depth and make this more Charlotte specific here, and here, before we publish it and before we put it out. But yeah, I would just say simply hit them with data, make them a part of the conversation, and just make it an ongoing conversation. One of the conversations that we're still having on the Charlotte Fire Department, I have it with Chief Winkles and Chief Scaris and Chief Johnson on a regular basis when I see them, is the pumps on ladder companies. We still run pumps on our truck companies in Charlotte. Our ladder companies are 100% operated as truck companies. We do not use the pumps on our ladders, period. Like, very rarely will you see a pump used on a ladder company in Charlotte. Not going to say it doesn't happen. Every once in a while it does, just because we have them. But our ladder companies are run as true blue truck companies. They're equipped as truck companies, they're operated as truck companies, but right now all of our ladders have pumps on them. So, that's a conversation that I'm still having. And I'm again, like, it's a conversation. It's not a, we don't need pumps. Pumps on our ladders are stupid. We didn't get these things off. Like, that's not the, if I went into every single conversation with these chief officers with that, I'm going to get, not only am I going to get, not only are they not going to listen to me, but they're not going to listen to me for anything ever again. You know, like you have to have a conversation with them, you know, and be like, you know, so the first time I had it, I was like, okay, what will get us to the point to where we can do this? You know, and so now we have some guidelines, things that we're saying, some targets that we're trying to hit so that we can start working that point, you know, and, you know, but yeah, I mean, make them a part of the conversation and make sure you're hitting them with data, not just an opinion.
Definitely love it. Love it. Thomas, I really appreciate, man. This has been an awesome conversation to have with you. You are also a part of the Insight Fire Training Cadre. So if anybody wanted to get a hold of you to you know, bring you guys in for thermal imaging classes, search classes, how would they go about contacting you?
Man, we've got so many ways. So yes, I'm the most senior instructor that Andy Starnes has got on Insight Training on the Insight Training Cadre. I've been with Andy for 10 years, teaching with him for 10 years. You can reach us on the website, Insight Fire Training, insightfiretrainingllc.com, Facebook page, Insight Fire Training LLC. We're on Twitter, we're on Snapchat. Actually, I don't think we're on Snapchat. I'm on Snapchat, but I don't think Andy's gotten the Snapchat yet, but he's on Twitter. He's on, you know, he's on every single social media platform that there is out there. We're probably most active on Facebook and Instagram. Or sorry, we're most active on Facebook. But yeah, Insight Training, and that's again Insight Training LLC. You can find me specifically at Instructor Thomas Anderson on Facebook. That's my public page. I also do have a private page that's just my name, Thomas Anderson. But yeah, highly encourage you to reach out, like it. I'm not the most active on the Facebook. Sometimes I'll go and post something every day for a week, and then I won't post shit for a month. So just kind of depends. Also our website, the Insight Fire Training LLC website, shows every single class that we have scheduled for the entire year. I think we're at like 60 some odd in-person events that we're doing next year. Or in 2025, as of right now, don't quote me on that number, but I know we're on a lot of events. We're going to be at FDIC this year. I'll be teaching our Intelligently Aggressive Search hot class, live fire hot class. It's 4 4-hour sessions is what we're doing. I'm also doing a lecture on Wednesday afternoon, in a general conference session called Peak Performance for the Intelligently Aggressive Search Crews. You know, lots of ways that you can see us, lots of ways that you can get out there and see us teach, or you know, be a part of it. But yeah, I mean, absolutely reach out on social media, email tanderson.insight, insight at gmail.com. That's my email address. Anybody can email me anytime they want to. Cell phone number 859-358-6201. Call me. Probably do me a favor and text me first and say, hey, my name is so and so from so and so. Got a question for you. Because if you just call me and I see a random number from freaking Florida, I'm probably not going to answer. But yeah, leave me a message, shoot me a text message. I'm an open book, man. Call me anytime.
Awesome. Awesome. Thomas, don't ever change. I took your class, your search class, me and a couple buddies from Morsel. Fantastic.
Thank
I
you,
can
man.
see why Chris truly enjoys you as a company officer. Don't
Thank
ever
you.
change. Keep going against the norm, man. And I really appreciate you doing this.
Hey man, I appreciate you having me on. This has been awesome. Great conversation. Great experience. Keep doing what you're doing too, man. Keep driving. Keep making the fire service better. And hey man, hope to see you on another one sometime.
Yes, sir.
If any of the listeners out there are or know of a great firefighter who embodies the principles of being a great communicator, goal-oriented, hardworking, humble, passionate, and professional, regardless of rank, career, or volunteer, contact me at studentofthegamefirepodcast@gmail.com. Until next time, stay focused, stay committed, and stay safe.